The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with John Gilroy of Lectromech, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy of Lectromech, providing solutions to design, certify, and maintain aircraft wire systems. Every week, John speaks with public and private sector IT experts about some of the IT trends and challenges facing agencies and industry. Now your host, John Gilroy.
Welcome to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. In the studio, Anthony Colomito, Chief Evangelist for a company called Boundless. How are you today, Anthony?
John, I'm well. A pleasure to be here. Thank you very much for the invite.
Boy, Boundless, it seems like it's a physical fitness training or you got something or other. What we're going to do today is take a few minutes and talk about your company and talk about what problems your company solves for my listeners. And in case you haven't figured it out, my listeners are federal IT professionals. They go to work at 9 o'clock in the morning. By 9:10, they're calling up suicide hotline. They don't know what to do. They get a problem. You know, their staff's been reduced. What's going to happen in the next 6 months? How do they solve this problem? They got this geographic information they got to manage. How do they do it? They don't have a budget. They want to go open source. And so they're getting pushed and pulled in all these directions. And hopefully the topic we're going to talk about today, geography and open source and your organization, could maybe, you know, if we have one listener that you help out today, we've won. So that's what we're
absolutely
trying to do.
Absolutely.
So before we begin, interesting name for a company. Tell us about the company and how you wound up working for them, please.
Yeah, sure. So Boundless started as a non-for-profit back in 2002, dedicated to helping the city of Newark determine a better way to route bikers around bike lanes in New York City. They developed a server-side geospatial software that would allow them to route effectively, cross bridges and tunnels, and maintain safety while they did so. Fast forward a few years, in 2009, that technology expanded to the point where it became downloaded about 20,000 times a year. People started to take notice, the federal government in particular. NGA, the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, saw the promise in the technology and decided to invest heavily in it to help make sure that it fulfilled its mission's needs. So in 2013, Boundless, the company that we are today, spun out of a non-for-profit to be a for-profit company. We have been through 5 rounds of IncuTel funding. We've gone through some VC funding as well. And now we're a multi-million dollar company with a open source geospatial stack to help folks answer questions about geospatial problems.
What a great story to tell. Humble beginnings, solve a problem, and then expand because there's a lot of problems involved. And I think if you realize what's happened in the last 10 or 15 years, just the amount of information is incredible. And the amount of geography information you have, interesting, this is blowing up all over the place. So I've had many, many people on the air who have done this interview show for 10 years. And many times the high-level govies will pound on the table and say, open source, open source, open source. And many of my listeners are sick of it. And they're scratching their heads going, well, how can open source help me? I mean, is this good or bad? I mean, is there security weaknesses? I mean, tell us about open source and your company and why my listeners should even be interested in open source.
Sure, yeah. No, so open source has many different advantages. I guess to start, kind of explain what open source is, a lot of folks have a confusion between open source data, which is information and data collected, you know, in the open, right? Twitter feeds, stuff that you find on Facebook. Open source software is software that is written in a way in which the source code is actually provided publicly, so out in the open. One of the biggest reasons people initially started to come to open source software was cost savings. There's no licensing involved. There's no penalty to scale up or out. I can deploy as many instances as I want, and there's no bill at the end of the day to do so. But what we're starting to see is many organizations are finding other benefits to open source beyond just cost savings. For one, your staff are not locked into a single vendor. Their skill sets are expanded by using multiple technologies created and contributed to by folks all around the globe. Another big benefit is because the technology's source code is out in the open, it actually tends to be more secure. Whereas commercial organizations use a security through obscurity model and say, yeah, our 10 engineers have locked this thing down solid, open source exposes the code for everyone to see. So there's less chance that there will actually be any malware or bugs or any type of weird things in the actual source code itself. So other organizations are realizing that open source is more secure than their commercial or proprietary components. Another big advantage is the ability to work on modern IT architectures. As we enter this age of streaming data and Internet of Things and sensor-based technologies, we're seeing more data than we've ever seen before. And it's really hard for traditional bare bones, you know, bare metal based technology to process that sheer number of data. So open source gives you the ability to scale out into these elastic environments, whether we're talking about virtualized containers, DevOps architectures where instances are scripted out elastically so that you can scale up, process a bunch of data, and then scale back down when you're done. So we're beginning to see that open source also fits very well into modern IT architectures. And so it's for this and many other reasons that open source has really caught the eye, not just of large organizations, but of the federal government. And in 2009, the DoD CIO basically wrote a memorandum of understanding that said the federal government's allowed to use open source technology provided that it's commercially supported, meaning if there is a problem, I can pick up a phone, I can call somebody, I know that there's a throat to choke, you know, when things go bad. And so Boundless provides that commercial support to open source geospatial, the same way Red Hat provides commercial support to the Linux operating system.
So Red Hat, a North Carolina-based company?
It is. It is a Raleigh, North Carolina-based company.
Like a lot of parallels with other things. Have you heard of a company called Sonatype?
I have, actually.
Yeah, the Sonatype model, they have repositories over on GitHub, and they work with that. So I think that's a way for listeners to, oh, I get it. And you can say, oh, so Red Hat supports Linux. Now, Linux is free. You can download it, and it's got people all over the world taking a look at it and making sure it's safe. And they provide a telephone you can call in case you're stuck. And so what you do is you say, well, yeah, open source is a good, safe way to go, and you can do it yourself if you want. And if you want a mechanic to help you change that alternator, well, we'll come in. And when I was in college, I would put in alternators, but now I don't. I hire mechanics to do that kind of work. And the same situation. I would imagine there are listeners who – know as much about geography as you and can download the code and run programs and fine. But other people, they may not have – typically it's with integrating other systems. I think that's a real concern. Is that a concern people have?
It is. I don't know if concern is the right word, but it certainly is something people consider. You know, they love to be able to do it themselves. They can download the software. It is open source. They can try and run it themselves. And when they get stuck, they can call us. But other organizations that have an operational mission would rather have us – you know, come in, jumpstart, maybe a 1 or 2 week jumpstart package, get them up and rolling, and then we kind of fall away and let them carry on. Others like to have us sit side saddle, you know, the very popular FTE model, the full-time equivalent model that a lot of the federal government uses where contractors sit side saddle to federal employees. We do offer that as well. So we do want to make sure that folks are successful, whether that's doing it on their own and calling us when they need help or simply helping to get them going. We're happy to do both.
I spent a lot of time consulting up in northern Canada. And what you do is you'd pull into a 7-Eleven and you'd plug your car in January and get your coffee and unplug it. And many times if you've got to plug it in, you'd need a jump start.
Yeah.
And so this is the phrase that you use on your website. Hey, you don't have to hire us for 10,000 hours. We'll come in, we'll put together a workshop, we'll get your ball going down the hill, and you have plenty of smart people there, and off you go. So I think that's a nice non-threatening concept where, oh my God, I gotta get married to this Anthony guy. No, he's gonna come in, show you two, and get out of there. So it's a nice, gives all kinds of flexibility, doesn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. It's very much like a SOCOM model, right? Parachute in, fix it, save the day, and then get on out. So
great. All kinds of terms that are associated with open source, and what Red Hat does is it offers platforms that can enable your use of open source software to better. And you folks have a platform too, is that right?
That's correct. We have an entire ecosystem of software that runs from the cloud and server side, the desktop side. A lot of the traditional GIS analysts who do a lot of the hardcore geography analytics use desktop software. And we've even got software that expands all the way out to tablets and mobile devices, either connected or disconnected, as well as a full complement of web technology to allow you to do answer all of your geospatial questions from any device that you happen to be using.
And if you have questions about this company, you can do what I do. Just go to Twitter and type in, they're at Boundless Geo, and they just have tons of tweets, all kinds of information and links to blogs, links to information. And if you think about the company geographic and there's visual aspect to it, their Twitter feed is very visual. I mean, it's like, you know, you don't have to get out a dictionary and sit there for 3 hours. You can be waiting for a bus, get out your phone, go Boundless and scroll through the Twitter feed, see what's going on. Oh, Anthony, who's coming in town? Oh, mark that. And you get on the bus or go, or I don't know where you would go to lunch or whatever. So it's a, I think it's you're telling the story visually because visual is in your DNA. And so it's a real nice. In fact, your website, I went to the website this morning, it was boundlessgeo.com. Easy, graphical, video, boxy, simple, almost like a geographer designer. I mean, it's almost like that was the input for the eye.
Yeah, I mean, aesthetics is extremely important, especially in the cartography world. So absolutely. I'm glad you're able to take that away. Hopefully our other listeners will too.
Let's take a break. come back and maybe define the fancy word cartography and talk more about what this means for my listeners. You are listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM in the studio. Anthony Colomito, the chief evangelist of Boundless. Welcome back to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM in the studio. Anthony Colomito, chief evangelist of Boundless. More information, go to boundlessgeo.com. There's two S's in there, boundlessgeo.com. All kinds of fun stuff there. Before the break, used a fancy word called cartography. That's going to impress some people, and some people don't know what it is. Tell us what cartography is and how you got interested in this whole field.
Yeah, cartography, basically it's the art and science of building maps. It's for a large word, it actually means something quite simple. I started as a meteorology major in college, believe it or not. I got really interested in the way in which weather patterns moved across the country.
Heavy math.
Heavy math. Yeah. And it was that, desire to learn, the desire to see things visually and to see and understand how the Earth affected weather patterns that really got me to switch over and move into geography, really understand how.
I imagine your parents looked at you and said, Anthony, you're working at McDonald's after you finish this degree. This is ridiculous. Did they say that to you?
It's funny. I was telling you earlier, a lot of women as I was dating coming up, joked that, you have a degree in geography, so you must know state capitals. That was the extent of what they thought I knew.
Wow. And so there is a practical application. I mean, if you just sit back and think about what's going on, let's toss out something like Amazon drone delivery. Do you think they have to know something about geography for that? I mean, this is basic as simple as that people are talking about. I mean, okay, is there traffic on the way to Philadelphia? Well, let me get out my ways. Well, do you think there's geography involved in that there, Anthony? Well, I hope so. So it's much more pervasive than people think, isn't it?
Absolutely. And we have to thank, companies like Google and Microsoft and Yahoo for making geography ordinary. I mean, we use maps now to get around, whether we're using Uber or hailing a cab or driving using Waze or Google Earth, Google Maps. We really have to thank them for making geography ordinary. It absolutely has a play in everything we do, whether it's understanding the weather for today when you step outside, navigating from here to Starbucks, or simply understanding where to put the next big box store. Geography has a part in all of it.
Making geography simple. That's good. At your website, you talk about something called a map-a-thon. Now, I know of a town called Marathon, and I know of Georgetown has a hackathon. So what is a mapathon?
It's actually the cross between those two things. So much like hackathons are an opportunity for smart developers, students to get together and really hack away at a problem to come up with a various different answers to a problem, usually in software code. Mapathons take that same approach with geospatial data. A lot of times, mapathons revolve around something called OpenStreetMap. It's the open source equivalent of Wikipedia. It's basically where anyone in the world, any citizen of the globe, can go and contribute their own lines, points, lines, and polygons to build a global data set of geospatial data. Mapathons offer an opportunity for students or anybody, really, to get together and focus on a particular geographic area to create data where there isn't any.
I have a strange connection to Latin America. My sister just spent 2 months in Medellin. And now my daughter's going there in February, and they're going to wander around and look for a hidden city or something. Now, my question is, now, if you think about Fairfax County, well, easy to get map information. What about, in the jungle outside of Colombia, Cali? I mean, that's the challenge, I would think, outside the United States.
Absolutely, especially in places like Colombia with triple canopy jungle where imagery, right, collected from satellites and planes
no vale.
Can't penetrate. Exactly. It's hard to get that. So areas that are either denied, areas that are hard to get to, areas that we don't typically go to very much. Prior to the earthquake in 2010 in Haiti, there actually wasn't a lot of data in Haiti, right? It's considered a third world country.
Yep. My daughter never plans a vacation for North Korea.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So hackathons and mapathons become opportunities for us to be able to pull that content together, to get people to focus on areas that typically wouldn't be focused on.
You know what Georgetown does is they sponsor the Hoya Hacks, and then companies line up to sponsor it because they go into a room and they sit on the floor with talented developers and they figure out who the smart ones are.
Yeah, they become great recruiting tools.
Really a great. I mean, it's, oh yeah, hey, my name's Anthony. I'm just a regular guy. Can I sit on the floor and work on this map? And, oh, really? You studied this in college? Well, and all of a sudden, then they can recruit really good talent that way. It's everyone wins. I mean,
and universities in particular love sponsoring them at their facilities. That way, again, it gives their students an opportunity to find potential job placement after school. It also provides them a taste of what the real world is like. How would I apply what I'm learning in my courses to a real world example? So universities, schools of all types love the hackathon, mapathon model, and they absolutely become good recruiting tools for organizations and agencies in the area.
When I talk to companies like yours, I meet you casually at an event or in an airport or something. I normally use my standard question is, what business problem do you solve? And you know, hey, I'm hungry, I'm going to get a donut. Okay. So from an agency's perspective, let's say someone from transportation is listening to this interview. So what business problem do you solve for them?
Yeah, especially in transportation, there's a couple different ways to look at it. From the civilian standpoint, how transportation agencies affect civilians, it could be everything from trying to understand how to build better roads or where to build better roads so that we better support ADA, folks with ADA disabilities, right? Putting in curb cuts where they are and where they aren't and where we need to focus on. It could be something even more simple, understanding better ways to determine when we need to repaint or repave roads, especially in an area here in DC where the salt is applied. We have freeze and thaw during the summer and winter. And of course, you know, the roads get tore up by all the vehicles. So if there's a better way to automate or approximate where areas need to be resurfaced, you can certainly use it in that aspect. From a more higher level, strategic level, you see individual municipalities and county Department of Transportations move their data up to the state level. And then from the state level, each state moves it up to the federal level. And what that does is it allows the federal government to have a more accurate, more timely data set that they can then plan against for things like understanding where we need to, you know, even the EPA, right? Understanding where to route trash, where to route hazardous materials, how best to route them around certain areas so we're not affecting a population if something were to go wrong. So being able to escalate that data from the low level all the way up to the national level is another way in which transportation is using spatial data and spatial information for their needs.
So my daughter studies civil engineering. We just talked about her. And for last Christmas, she gave me a book on water. And this is a very important topic for the millennials now, this whole water issue. It's really hot. And so I'm reading this book real carefully, and there is a geospatial distribution of cholera in England in the mid-19th century where they used geospatial information to determine that this one well was creating all kinds of problems. And my kids and I got together on Thanksgiving. We talk about this. And then I go to your website, and you're talking about the well in 19th century England, geospatial. So geospatial data can make sure that we survive. I mean, this is an application. That's just one little tiny health application.
Absolutely. And that case, John Snow and his famous cholera map, is a textbook, literally a textbook application.
Yeah.
It's taught many universities. It's on the cover of many textbooks. First case of truly using geospatial knowledge to solve a problem and develop an answer. Back then in the 1890s, it's still just applicable today in 2016.
It sure is. Go to Zambia. I mean, go to Sudan. I mean, take apply it right to. I have a friend who goes to Sudan every 6 months and he works with a nonprofit there. And guess what? That's a concern is water, and we take it for granted here. Every year, Salesforce has a big event in town here. And they get out the drum, and Benioff comes in, and they get the marching band, and it's huge. And so when I think of customer relationship management CRM, I think of Salesforce. I might think of the Microsoft one, but not really. I think of Salesforce. And so in doing research for this interview, I stumbled on something called geospatial CMS. So what is CMS? Is that what it is? Is it CRM? I don't know what it is.
It's a CMS. It's a content management system. And so what we've done is we've taken the same approach that a user would go to Google for. I want information about something. I Google search, Christmas gifts, and I get a whole indexed list of Christmas gifts back to me. What we're finding is while the need for geospatial data grows, there's so much of it and there's not an effective way to search for it. So we've created a geospatial content management system. It's basically a geography Google, and it allows you to keyword search and discover geospatial data sets that meet your needs. Maybe you are looking for data sets related to water and cholera and how standing water affects that and how best to get rid of it and mitigate it. Maybe you're looking for something more simple. I just want road data for a certain county. Maybe I want to understand the parcels around my neighborhood. My latest Facebook post, believe it or not, was to my residents' HOA Facebook page. They had questions about some of the building in the area, and I was able to go to my county GIS website, discover parcel data, create a map for them very quickly, and post that so folks could see where potential building would occur over the next 3 or 4 months. And so that content management system enables that search and discovery of geospatial data.
Yeah, it's so fascinating. It has so many different applications. You know, when we live in Fairfax, we bring in PhD candidates from George Mason University, and we'd have them over for holidays, like people from China, Thanksgiving and Christmas. We did this for many years. And one woman I remember was a geography PhD. And I said, what application? She has? She says, I'm in China. It has, I'm the most popular person in China because there's so much going on there and they don't know what's, and growth and expansion and new and trains. And she says, and she's really in demand. And she's doing a great job over there, learned at George Mason, went back to China, is very, very successful. Let's take a break and come back, talk more about geography and about Boundless and maybe some applications for our listeners. You are listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM in the studio. Anthony Colomito, Chief Evangelist of Boundless. Welcome back to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM in the studio. Anthony Colomito, Chief Evangelist of Boundless, B-O-U-N-D-L-E-S-S. We're talking about geography, geospatial information. If you go to their website, you stumble on something. It's kind of a hard for me to understand. O-G-I-S, O-G-I-S platform. What is that? Or QGIS? Is it QGIS?
Yeah, so QGIS. QGIS is the world's leading open source desktop geospatial application. I know that was a mouthful. Basically, it's like Microsoft Word you use on your computer at home, only it's for making maps, working with spatial data, and building out answers to geospatial questions. It is based on, the name comes from Quantum GIS, which is what it used to be called about 5 or 6 years ago. But the conventions within the geospatial community have just shortened it to QGIS. And again, QGIS forms one of the pieces of our supported open source stack. When you work with Boundless and you use our technology, QGIS becomes a piece of that overall geospatial ecosystem that you can use to help answer your geospatial questions.
You know, I've been listening to this interview and talking to you and scratching my head and saying, well, what do you read? I mean, how can you possibly keep up with all the changes in this world? I mean, this has got to be a confusion. I mean, so much open data, so much settled information, new streams, sensors, people adding stuff, the open source adding. So how do you keep up? What do you read?
Yeah, it's a great question. My life is, I live it by tweets and blogs and I don't know if you've heard of Flipboard, the app for your phone, basically a news aggregator. I live by news aggregators. I have to constantly read about, I don't know, 3-4 times a day. I'm checking news to keep up with way technology changes. But from a company standpoint, being an open source organization means we have contributors from all over the globe, which means the best and brightest have the ability to contribute their thoughts, their code contributions, their ideas to our technology stack. And so for as much as we, as the employees of the company, need to stay current on technology, it's nice to know that a global community of users from all around the world are also contributing best of breed ideas to the technology stack. So we do a little bit of staying on top of things as much as we can anyway, but we certainly leverage that global user community to help us.
So let's say people are listening to this interview and there's snow on the ground and the Redskins have already won the Super Bowl and everyone's happy. They're thinking about practical applications for their own agency. And so what would be a good application? Just give me a sample of maybe an agency you've worked with in the past, maybe a commercial civilian one or something like that.
Yeah, no, I mean, the Department of State, USAID, they typically use geospatial applications, including ours, for humanitarian assistance, humanitarian aid. Trying to understand, where there'll be food scarcity now and into the future, try and predict how much food supplements they need to bring to certain parts of the world. NOAA and the National Weather Service certainly use geospatial information to model climate, weather forecasting, climate forecasting, both long and short range. The Armed Services certainly uses our technology to help route them from point A to point B in the safest way possible, never taking the same route twice so that the enemy can't build pattern information on them. And for operational planning as well, logistics planning before they go on mission and operation. One of our largest users, NGA, again, the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, largest user of geospatial information in the federal government, they use our information both domestically for emergency response, disaster relief. I'm from North Carolina. We just had Hurricane Matthew come through a couple months ago, and NGA used the technology to help understand where aid needed to be for residents of North Carolina. If you go to their website, nga.mil, you'll actually see map information on there and how they've used geospatial technology to make information available to the public. But they're also using it for intelligence purposes overseas. Again, mission planning, helicopter landing zones for bringing in food and materials for missions. So it ranges the gauntlet, everything from humanitarian assistance to climate change and climate prediction to helping operational missions from the military standpoint.
So there may be listeners who, let's say they work for a three-letter agency, I don't know, maybe something like that. And normally these people may not want to call you or email you, but a lot of times if they're an event, they'll walk up to you and go, well, you know, that's very interesting, Anthony, and I have a friend who's got this problem, and how does this work? So do you ever do any speaking invitations in town? Can people actually grab you by the collar and say, hey, come over here, buddy?
Yeah, absolutely, we do. We try to go to a lot of the big big trade shows in the area, you know, whether it's InfoAg, whether it's, you know, we have our own Spring Symposium here in February, which details will be available on our website shortly, but it'll be mid-February. We actually travel all throughout the country. We have offices in St. Louis, in Florida. We have offices in Louisiana. And so we typically try to hit local events in those areas as well. We are planning to be at PyCon. If anybody's a Python developer listening, I'm sure there are a few. So we do make our rounds. We have an events page on our website. I encourage everyone to check that out, where we keep a latest tab of where we're going to be.
You know, it's interesting about your website. If you go there, instead of like having a text list of where all your employees are, you actually have a map and like little pins of, well, here's one in Argentina, or here's one in Hawaii, here's one in Bosnia, here's one in North Carolina.
We do.
And so you're eating your own dog food here, aren't you?
It's exactly right. It was one of the best ways for us to test whether or not our web-based technology worked correctly, was to feed it to ourselves and put it on our website.
Okay, so let's say people listen to this interview and they're kind of intrigued, they want to learn more, so they go to YouTube, type in your name, and then they go to Twitter and read a few articles, maybe they read your blog post at Boundless Geo, and they show up at your little conference. And they, so is this like a service? Is this a subscription? Is this, you buy this? Or how exactly can they buy this?
Yeah, it's a great question. So again, it's open source software, so there's no software to buy, right? There's no licensing for our software. You can deploy it as much as you want. That's the beauty of open source. What we do as Boundless is we provide that commercial support and maintenance, basically an insurance policy for the use of open source software. And that's a big deal. A lot of folks are a little hesitant to go the open source route. You know, again, a lot of the common problems, they feel it's less secure. They feel like there's not somebody they can call when they run into problems. And so Boundless meets that need by providing that insurance policy, that safety net for that software. We also do have a subscription service for, we have an ecosystem of supported software that you can buy into, a monthly subscription that you can, you know, purchase and stop at any time, that provides supported web-based and desktop-based geospatial software based on that open source community. But again, with that support and maintenance behind it to ensure your success. So whether you're a large enterprise and kind of want to go all in, or you want to go month to month as an individual, you can certainly do that. One other thing I'll mention, we do have an education program. So for both students and educators, you have access to all of that great commercial support maintenance for free. There's no charge for educational institutions or students to use it.
I'm thinking of another parallel here. Maybe it's like WordPress. WordPress is free, but what you want to do is you want to get plugins and have them updated. And what you want to do is probably maybe have a backup service. And what you probably want to do is maybe have some kind of a spam control. And these are all available, a lot of the free models, and you just plug them right in. Now, if you want to have reporting, then all of a sudden it's a minor, small fee monthly for a service for reporting different. So I think there's a similar type model there, isn't it?
It is.
The plugins.
It is. Very similar. Very similar. Again, it allows organizations who are maybe unsure about open source to try to test the waters and know that they've got a backup plan. One of the things we like to tell folks is, you know, we certainly encourage all users to check out open source. We think that the open source geospatial stack is very strong. But if you're hesitant, we encourage you to do a hybrid model where find your biggest pain point, whether that's your geospatial database technology or geospatial server-side technology, swap that one piece out for open source in like a hybrid model. So you can continue to run what you've got, leverage your existing purchases, your existing software platform, but inject the open source where you can, and slowly and gradually over time. And that hybrid model seems to work best for most folks. It prevents that sudden change in architecture while allowing you to benefit from open source as much as possible. And Boundless is there all along the way to provide that insurance policy.
Do you have partners in town that represent you here? Or?
We do. We have all sorts of partners, content partners, services partners who help implement the technology, as well as data partners who provide data sets that folks can use. It'd be hard to name them all. But there are certainly both content and services partners in the area.
What about a company like Tableau Software? Do you work with them? Do you compete with them? I mean, where do you fit in with them?
That's a great question. Tableau you know, I don't want to again pigeonhole any one software, but they have a really, really good front end technology, really good web-based, tablet-based application. Our technology in that case would come in behind it, right? We would be the data and services that would then be presented in that front end. You know, again, if you're thinking Amazon and Amazon Web Services, right, our technology runs on their infrastructure stack. So we really do partner and interoperate with many different technologies. And again, that's the core part of being open source. It must be open. It must be interoperable. It must work with other technologies in different areas.
We don't do Tableau. We make Tableau better.
That's yeah. We're the BASF of Geospatial. That's right.
Geospatial. There's another tagline for
you. There
you
go. There you go.
Let's take a break and talk more about Geospatial when we get back. You are listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. In the studio, Anthony Colomita, the chief evangelist of Boundless. Welcome back to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. In the studio, Anthony Colomita, chief evangelist of Boundless. Well, here's the last block of information for our listeners. I'm trying to come up with a nice nutshell, nice summary of what your company can offer my listeners so they can read online and then do more research about your company and then maybe go to an event and grab you and talk to you and develop a relationship and see if you can really help them out. And I think you've written a blog that pretty much covers the big 5 points. Tell us about your blog and where they can read it.
Yeah, so latest blog post up on boundlessgeo.com talks about the new Boundless ecosystem. What we've done is we've essentially created a commercially supported open source geospatial ecosystem. In the center of that ecosystem is a content management system for folks to be able to find training, support, find resources to be successful, things like style files and data sets. And then along the outside of that core, you've got individual software products that help you answer questions to your geospatial problems, whether that be at the desktop level, server side, in the cloud, or on a mobile device. We've provided an entire open source ecosystem for you to be successful and then have provided commercial support and maintenance for that so that you can feel free to use that software in an operational setting without having to worry about any of the traditional issues that come along with open source.
B as in boy, BOUNDLESSGEO.com, and go to the blog and get all the different concepts. I read the blog this morning and it talked about named users. It sounds like Seinfeld, a name. So what is a named user?
A lot of cloud-based or SaaS software as a service models nowadays leverage named users or credits to basically keep track of how much you're using that service. It's a way to keep track of how often you've used that service. Boundless doesn't have that. We don't believe in that. Being open source at our roots, we don't think we should keep tabs on how much you're using the software. It pretty much goes against everything we stand for. So we don't have named users accounts. We don't have credit models where you pay to play. You're simply able to use the software as much as you need to get your job done.
And also, in the blog, you talk about it's designed for modern IT. Does that mean it's responsive? Does that mean it's secure? What does that phrase mean?
Yeah, and more modern technology, more and more modern IT architectures are revolving around containers, such as Docker containers or microservices, these small but fast or powerful instances of software that are ballooned out elastically to meet a processing need and then scaled back down when you're done. The Boundless technology stack, again, being born from open source, works both on Linux, it works on Windows, it works on Mac OS. It's designed to be scripted out through Ansible, Puppet, and Chef, these automation technologies that script out microservice deployments. It is designed from the ground up to work in these elastic cloud-based architectures that we see today in modern IT.
I keep thinking of interoperability. And 5 years ago, I would never use the word puppet or even a container. That's something down in the dock, But this is very practical, small microservices to give flexibility for developers.
And, absolutely.
And they love having 4 or 5 different of those tools to pick. Oh, I'm gonna use Chef here. No, I'm going to use Puppet. No, I'm going to use Docker. Oh, I'm going to DockerCon, by the way, Anthony, okay? And it's like a chef would have different types of spatulas and use one for this application. No, it's not going to work here. And I think that's a nice an open source way to let the user pick the tool that's best for them. Because if you tell a software developer to use this tool, guess what they're going to do? They're going to throw a chair at you.
Yeah.
They're going to want to sample 5 and figure what's the best for that particular application.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
We go to events all the time, and I always meet people, and they listen to my show, and they go, yeah, that Anthony guy, huh? Is he a nerd? What's he like, really? And so I've come up with a scientific 10-question test that's going to find out if, in fact, you are a card-carrying nerd. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. Strap yourself in. First question, do you have an Instagram account?
I actually don't. My wife does.
I'm not going to have an account. How many cell phones have you just impulsively bought for yourself in the last year?
Two, actually.
That's not bad. That should be like six, but it's okay. Do you have a personal Twitter feed?
I do. It's at Gio Calamito.
And do you have a Snapchat account?
That I don't.
What kind of smartphone you got there, buddy?
I do have an iPhone. I am an iOS user.
And what's the most popular app on that guy?
Normally, it's Storm. It's a weather app by the Weather Underground. But I think because of shopping this month, it's Amazon. Must be Amazon.
Apparently. So we break into your house. How many tablet devices do you see floating around there?
Oh, gosh. Probably four or five.
Third point. And what was your most recent post in social networking?
I actually posted earlier this morning. I posted maps I created for my HOA to show where all the parcels were being bought up and sold. So
if you got a sweater on, I can't tell. Is that an Apple Watch there? Do you have one on order for Christmas?
You know, it's not. I do have one on for order for Christmas,
you
but
do?
this one is not. Too many federal buildings to go in and out of.
Digital. You spend half your day just getting things.
That's right.
So the last book you read, was it electronic or was it paper?
You know, the last book I read was, it was actually a paperback. It's actually called Life in the Fast Lane by a man named Steve Matchett. I follow Formula One pretty intimately. And Steve Matchett was a Benetton mechanic back in the 1990s. And he wrote basically a manifesto about his time working as a Formula One pit mechanic.
I know people in California, they follow it. They got to get up like at 2 o'clock in the morning and, okay, it's wake up, start drinking beer and watching Formula One because it's all in Europe and it's in the middle of the night, isn't it?
That's right. But I love it. So,
It's hard to predict an auto race who's going to win. It's hard to predict what's going to happen with technology. But I'm going to ask you anyway, Anthony. You're in the hot seat. So 5 years from now, we do this interview again, and you're going to say, you know, John, I never thought of X, Y, and Z was going to have the impact. I didn't thought that virtual reality was going to have as big an impact as it did or didn't. So where do you see this whole technology heading in the next 5 years?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the two biggest trends that I see right now, one is certainly, you know, what we call business intelligence, right? Being able to use AI, to be able to use a software as a service to basically pull or tug at information from this massive set of data that we're going to be amassing pretty soon. With all the Internet of Things sensors coming online, we're going to be bringing in more and more data than we ever have before. How do we make sense of that? And it's going to be the business intelligence tools that are going to be able to pull out the nuggets, right? Be able to string together individual piece parts throughout the different disparate data sets to find a concise answer to a problem. And I think that relates to the second big trend, which is smart cities. As more and more municipalities understand how to use geospatial technology, they're using increased IT power with all of that increased geospatial data to help understand how better to, for instance, do road maintenance, how better to reroute water and stormwater waste, how better to understand the power grid and how all three of those things fit together. Understanding the different disparate data sets and how they play together to make the city more efficient, both for its constituents and for the policymakers that have to dictate what those constituents live within.
You know, 7 years ago, people might have complained. They might have said, geez, we don't have enough data to solve this problem. We need more data, But today, for my generation, it's like Bruce Springsteen, 500 channels and nothing to watch. For your generation, it's like 500 terabytes of information and no understanding.
Yeah.
And that's what you're seeking is just, who cares if it's 5 terabytes or 500 terabytes? Maybe a measly old megabyte can help you. But that finding that megabyte, that's the tough one, isn't it?
It's all about the nugget. You got to be able to find that nugget. And hopefully technologies like artificial intelligence and virtual reality will certainly help that. But it absolutely is a problem that we're going to have to face here very soon.
AI. I was talking to some folks at Interior, and they're using artificial intelligence to help manage their data center. And that's pushing it. I can see with mapping, though, it just seems like the human eye can see subtleties and difference easier than, I don't know, has AI been applied to geography as well?
It has, actually. I just had dinner the other night with a large agriculture company here in the U.S. They're actually using AI to enable both homeowners and farmers to be able to snap a picture of a weed and send that up to their web service. Artificial intelligence then analyzes the picture, figures out what type of weed it is, and then sends back information about, you know, what pesticides or herbicides you need to kill it, how to prevent it going forward, where it grows most often, and those types of things. So a little bit of a stretch in terms of geography, but simply using the graphic, the picture of that weed and where the picture's taken in terms of the climate that it's growing and the type of soil that it's growing in, helps then this application identify what that weed is and how best to treat it. That's a very simplified use case of AI in geography, but I think it's a very powerful one that can certainly be understood by everybody.
10 o'clock tomorrow morning, I had a telephone call with a guy who runs Precision Agriculture, and that's what they want to do. They want to look at a field and say, okay, water is like gold, so we don't want to waste water. We can use geo information to find out exactly how much water we're going to use and when. And guess what? It may change this year and vary all the time. And so you see someone on that tractor over there, who's that country bumpkin? No, that guy's plugged in. That guy's got, he knows exactly how much fertilizer to put, how much water to put, when to put it, where to put it, and different parts of, and it's not like, you know, some guy with a plow and a horse. These are almost like big data people on tractors, big data on tractors. It's a huge world, and the amount of agricultural products that we export. No one can believe that whole world of agriculture is so beyond most people.
Yeah, and actually, it's funny you mention it. In January, Boundless is going to actually host a webinar with another large agriculture company specifically about precision agriculture. So again, I encourage your listeners to take a look at our website, take a look at our events page, keep track on social media. We love to post all of those things on social media and learn more about how precision agriculture and geography play together.
Right. And that's where you get environmental respect awards, because all of a sudden, especially in California, they do respect water more than in Ohio or in Virginia. But if you're going to respect the planet and the people in their 20s are going to live in it the next 40 or 50 years, you have to take the data that you have and be able to apply it to being able to eat in the next years. Maybe feeding the world is what the agriculture folks say. Look, we're feeding the world here in Missouri and Kansas. Why? Because we're smart enough to know and take advantage of these data sets, which we didn't have 5-7 years ago.
Absolutely.
What a great story to tell. Well, thank you very much for coming in today. You've been listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. I'd like to thank my guest, Anthony Calamito, the Chief Evangelist of Boundless.